Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Shlom. Do you know how many steps it is from the ground level up to Sherlock Holmes' study at 221B Baker Street? Do you know how many steps it is up your own front porch, for that matter? Our guests this week certainly know the famous 17 steps and lots more. Their knowledge of the world of Sherlock Holmes is encyclopedic. Scott Monty and Bert Wolder are the hosts of two podcasts, I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, an hour-long program which deals with the world of Sherlockians and Holmes in pop culture, and Trifles, a 15-minute show that breaks down some of the interesting details in the 60 original stories by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Both are highly respected business professionals. Monty was the head of social media for the Ford Motor Company from 2008 to 2014, and he's currently the CEO and co-managing partner of Brain Trust Partners. The Economist recently ranked him number one in a list of 25 social business leaders. Wolder is also a marketing professional who is currently chief marketing officer for EMSI, a leading national provider of medical information. But in their spare time, they are Sherlockians of the highest order. Let's find out about how they got to be two of the world's foremost experts on the world of Sherlock Holmes and Dr. John H. Watson. So let's meet them in a place where it's always foggy and 1895, shall we? Scott Monty and Bert Wolder, welcome to Blue Dot.
Well, thank you. We're happy to be here.
It's our great pleasure.
Well, I'd kind of like to start out with, are you familiar with the Flame Challenge from the Alan Alda Center for Communicating Science?
Yes, I am.
Yes, yeah. You are?
No, I'm so, not.
Yeah, this is, you know, Alan Alda, who's obviously a great actor and starred in MASH for years and years, also has a powerful interest in science, founded an institute to teach people in the sciences how to communicate to the general public. And one of his rubrics is to ask people to describe things like, what is a flame? And he, I think, annually comes up with a challenge along those lines. I think that's curated by school children, if I remember correctly. And there's a competition for the best explanation of something like that.
That's right. And this year's flame challenge is, what is climate, appropriately? So I'd like to turn it around a little bit, though, and pose a question to you, but with the same target audience in mind. Very intelligent, very engaged 11-year-olds. Who is Sherlock Holmes, or perhaps what is Sherlock Holmes?
So who or what is Sherlock Holmes? Well, there are a number of ways to answer this, and I think that's what makes it so fascinating. At its very core, Sherlock Holmes is a character created by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle over 130 years ago, who lives on in the original 60 stories that were written about him, and in every other form of media that you can imagine. And Sherlock Holmes is essentially synonymous with detective.
Well, that is a great answer. I think for an 11-year-old, I would probably say Sherlock Holmes is like Mickey Mouse. He's like Tarzan. He's like Superman. He's a wonderful character, but also a symbol. He is, as Scott says, synonymous with the great detective, but also he's a great hero. He's the hero of 60 tales written by Arthur Conan Doyle over a very long period of time. He lives in Victorian England, and he's a hero and a symbol of problem solving, of justice, of unraveling great mysteries, and he's a lot of fun.
That's, I have to give Bert due credit for that one, because that is almost exactly what Edgar Smith said in the Baker Street Journal in 1946, that not only there and then, but here and now, he stands before us as a symbol, if you please, of all that we are not, but ever would be. And if we really want to extend this, in addition to the character, there are so many people that have been touched by Sherlock Holmes in one way or another. People that have read the stories, people that have seen the television shows, people that have listened to the adventures on radio, people that show up on weekends and even weeknights to gather together in groups, large and small, to discuss the stories and to celebrate their love of this character that they have in common. So for many people, Sherlock Holmes is a great uniting figure that brings us together.
Well, as you know, the world of big-budget Hollywood entertainment is quite dominated by superheroes nowadays. And one of my students, a ninth grader, asked me the other day, who's your favorite superhero? You know, Batman, Superman. And I said, well, you know, I really don't have one. And left it at that. And I said, but I'm glad you enjoy those movies. And then that night, I was sitting at home and I was listening to Trifles, and it's like it came to me. It's like, why didn't I tell him I have a superhero? It's Sherlock Holmes.
Oh, that's lovely. Well, you know, years ago when the Batman craze was really popular in the States in the 1960s with Adam West and Burt Ward, there was a musical on Broadway launched by a great impresario named Alexander Cohn. It was a musical all about Sherlock Holmes, and it was called Baker Street. And part of his promotions, his publicity, his signage for that musical was a big billboard that said, "The First Caped Crusader."
I remember hearing about that as well, and it happened around the same era. It was during A Study in Terror with John Neville. It would have been about 1965, 66 or so. You sure you're not confusing the two?
Oh, really? Well, maybe I am. Was that with the Neville movie? Because that was like a year or two earlier.
Yeah.
But I know that Cohen did something similar with POWs and ZAMs and things.
That's the one.
That's the one?
Yeah.
Well, maybe I'm just conflating both of them then. Or maybe it was just John Neville.
It could have been both, because I think we've seen time and again over the course of decades that there's a waxing and waning in the level of popular interest in Sherlock Holmes. And most recently, I think we've seen this in the competing interest between the Robert Downey Jr. movies, the Benedict Cumberbatch series on the BBC, and of course, Elementary on CBS with Johnny Lee Miller. So I think a number of folks in the entertainment industry get all hyped up about it simultaneously as well.
Well, I'd like to switch gears a little bit to talk about you two. Tell me a bit about your origins, both of you, and where you first discovered because you obviously have this deep and abiding love of this character and all the characters in the canon. When did you both discover that and find that it resonated with you? And when did you find each other as friends?
Well, you know, every good superhero has an origin story. And in my case, I first discovered Sherlock Holmes on my rocket ship on the way over from Krypton. No, wait, that was Superman. Hang on. High school is where I discovered Sherlock Holmes, reading the short stories one summer at the beach. Started back in the fall, and we were required to do a research paper, and my teacher instructed me to call up the local television station because there was a man who had this Sherlock Holmes club that he ran, and wouldn't I interview him and use him as a primary source? And that's where I met Harold Tyke Niver, a member of the Baker Street Irregulars, who has become a lifelong friend and who introduced me to all of this. And that's when I started going to meetings of the men on the tour in Connecticut, and eventually branched out to all the New England societies before becoming an investitured member of the Baker Street Irregulars.
Well, we all have sort of similar connections, I think. I think if you look at the community of people who love Sherlock Holmes, they generally tended to encounter, you know, the men and the women tended to encounter the character, the stories first, in school or when they were at an impressionable age. I remember I encountered Sherlock Holmes first in the fifth grade because I was, like many Sherlock Holmes enthusiasts, introverted, bookish-oriented kid who loved libraries. And so there was a collection of Sherlock Holmes stories in the school library, which for my little self was a very big, thick book full of illustrations. So in addition to the attractiveness of the stories and how interesting they were, the idea that I would be having this big adult grown-up book, somehow made an impression on me. And then my interests expanded as Holmes became sort of returned to the popular culture. You know, there'd been a while until the late 1950s when interest in Holmes was sort of dormant. But after that, and I was in school in the 1960s, interest began to reemerge again, and there were some big publishing events. And for me, it was the publishing of the first annotated Sherlock Holmes by William S. Baring Gould. When that came out, the idea that there would be an annotated collection that would explain all the little things that I might not have understood, like what's a hansom cab and what some of these newspaper references were, that was profoundly appealing. And so I got a copy of that, and that's where I learned that there were other people who had also this shared interest. And so that was my first connection to Sherlock Holmes. And through those societies, those gatherings, is when I first met Scott back in, I think, the Truman administration. Scott, well, actually, he hadn't even been born then.
I was wearing my I Like Ike pin, I think.
Yes, I remember you, and Spats. Yes, Spats and an I Like Ike pin.
That was a P.G. Woodhouse novel, Young Men in Spats.
Oh, that's
right. I recall.
Well, I had my Nicks on Nixon pin on, so sorry.
Now, Bert, you left out one enticing detail in your origin story there. When you found that big book, that tome, that made an impression on you, you took it up to your teacher and said, you don't recall what you said.
Oh, I'm sorry, I was on mute. Yes, I do. I do recall. I took it up to my teacher and I said, "Hey, Mrs. Ritchie, look, heavy reading. I thought this was a great joke." I was the only one. I think she looked at me, or maybe past me, or maybe at her watch. I don't remember.
You know, I'd kind of like to use an analogy of golf. I consider myself, I love the Sherlock Holmes stories. And when I kind of went off the deep end, as it were, was when I discovered the Granada series on PBS with Jeremy Brett. And I kept wondering to myself, why do I love this so much? And I started to read the stories. And it was when I discovered you guys and your podcasts that really started to deepen that. So I kind of compare myself to, I'm a high handicap weekend golfer who struggles to break 100. And you guys, to me, are like Jordan Spieth and Dustin Johnson.
Oh, and those are basketball players, are they?
Yes. Or I'm playing T-ball and you're in the major leagues.
Oh, well, that's very kind. You know, I don't have that sense of myself at all. I still, it's odd, though. I think most people, it depends on how they articulate it to themselves and what their own subjective sense of the world is. But there are certainly people, and I'm certainly one of them, who don't fundamentally have a different view of themselves that fundamentally changes from the time they're in their teens to the time they become an adult. And I still feel like that goofy kid, you know, who liked the stuff and had these peculiar interests, classical music for a while. I collected coins, Sherlock Holmes, Victorian England. You know, I remember being in the library reading through all of Alexandre Dumas and the Count of Monte Cristo and things like that when everybody else was doing things, you know, more typically kiddish than I was. So,
well, yeah, I mean, I think we appreciate that sentiment, Dave, and we probably don't stop to think about ourselves in such terms on a regular basis. But when it comes down to our, if we want to continue on this theme, our superpowers, one is that we have a lifetime of reading and enjoying Sherlock Holmes, and the associated scholarship and discussion around the character, which gives us this kind of massive internal database, if you will, of information that's at our fingertips inside of our brains. And at the same time, I think we also have a good relationship together where Bert and I, as we did when we attended meetings in the same states or the same cities, we just enjoyed conversation. We enjoyed each other. We enjoyed talking with people. We enjoyed learning about people. And I think over time, over the course of the last 10 or 11 years, as we have done the original I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere podcast, it's honed our interview capabilities, our skills with our guests. And then when we added on Trifles, it was simply an extension of that, all of that information that was pent up in our minds. And hearing our listeners from the other show say, well, you know, this is fascinating what you're finding out from these guests, but I want to know more about the stories. I want to know why Sherlock Holmes said something this way, or how it is that he was supposed to have, a bow window with a secret entrance from his bedroom, but wasn't there a fireplace in the way based on the way it was described in another story? Can you square that for me? And that's how we came up with the second podcast, Trifles. And again, it was just a combination of our skills and our hobby and our passion.
Yeah, but that's a great point, but it's also really indicative about what's different in Sherlock Holmes. If you stop to think about it, there are plenty of literary societies in the world. There are people who love John Keats and Jane Austen and Shakespeare and Charles Dickens, but there is not a similar body of what we in the Sherlockian world called Sherlockian scholarship around the activities, the life, the time, the details of Holmes and his cases and adventures, as Scott mentioned, and these questions about how could there be a bow window here and yet another door over there. And it's because of, I think, two fundamental things. One is that the author, Arthur Conan Doyle, we should say that many of us play the game that sort of started back in the 1920s when the stories were still being published for the first time, which was to take the presentation of Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson literally, that these are the cases of Sherlock Holmes, the world's first consulting detective, as reported by his friend and colleague John Watson. And if you do that, you then bump into inconsistency. So, for example, Watson says a particular case took place during a year when we know Holmes was believed dead. Well, how could that be? Or, as Scott mentioned, the bow window and the door here, and exploring those inconsistencies. So on the one hand, it's due to the fact that the author, Arthur Conan Doyle, frankly did not pay all that much attention to the timeline, the arc of history he was creating for all these people. And in fact, in some cases, the names of characters change from one story to another. And the second thing is that Holmes is only on stage, is only seen in the stories doing really remarkable things, revealing a denouement, asking questions, coming to conclusions. And as such, he's lightly sketched, and that gives people lots of opportunity to bring their imaginations to bear about what he would be really like, what he might have been doing elsewhere, what his family history was like, so on and so forth.
You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm your host, Dave Shlom. After a short break, we'll return to the world of Sherlock Holmes with Scott Monty and Bert Wolder. Stay with us.
Thank you.
Sherlock Holmes inspired my love of science in many ways. As an anthropologist that does forensics, I love how Holmes makes science applicable to human behavior, as he was a master of forensic science, physical anthropology, and archaeology. From stride, blood droplets, ear formation, stature, and physical countenance, he could deduce much about a person's size, shape, characteristics, and even health. That, and he knew about diseases, which are always exciting. This is the cool thing about Scott and Burke's work with I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere. They highlight these interesting aspects of Holmes's skills.
And we're back. Thanks to Dr. Carlina Delacova, professor of anthropology at the University of South Carolina, for that. She's a member of the Baker Street Babes. Now let's return to the guys, Scott Monty and Burt Wolder of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere.
You guys definitely have gone off the deep end, as it were, into this world of Sherlock Holmes, in a good way, I think. Explain to those of us listening who don't know about this world that's out there, the world of Sherlockian scholarship. What is the Baker Street Irregulars?
Well, let's back up to the early 1900s. There was an Oxford Don by the name of Ronald Knox, Father Ronald Knox, and he initially wrote a piece of scholarship that was really more satire. It was called Studies in the Literature of Sherlock Holmes, and what he was trying to do with that piece was to show just how pretentious biblical literary analysis was, and to extend that to popular culture that effectively everyone could understand. But that basically, over the years, became the anchor, became the basis by which many Sherlockians started, as Burt said, playing this game. So in 1934, a bookman, a literary gent, he was a columnist for the Saturday Review of Literature. He was an author, he was a playwright. Christopher Morley decided that he would put together this group. And Morley was an inveterate founder and joiner of clubs. One of my favorite clubs that he ever founded was the 3 Hours for Lunch Club, which I think anybody can get behind. That has faded from view, although Bert has done a remarkable job of resurrecting that at least once a year. But in 1934, Morley decided that, again, doffing his cap to popular culture, saying, why don't we form a little group of people who enjoy the Sherlock Holmes stories? And I think it was, about 8 or 10 people that gathered at that first dinner of the Baker Street Irregulars in December of 1934. And do you know, of the hundreds of clubs that Morley created over the years, the Baker Street Irregulars today is the only club of his that is still extant. And they met for a couple more years. And then in 1940, an enterprising vice president at the General Motors Corporation came along and said, what's this Baker Street Irregulars thing all about? I like Sherlock Holmes. I've been writing about Sherlock Holmes myself. Can we reinvigorate it? Can we meet on a regular basis again? And Morley said, hey, look, if you want to administer the thing, be my guest. And Edgar Smith did just that and was an amazing administrator, leading the Baker Street Irregulars for 20 years. And in 1946, because of all of the scholarship that he saw, he decided to bring it together under the cover of the Baker Street Journal. For a businessman, this was kind of a natural title, owing its title to the Wall Street Journal as well. It became a quarterly publication published by the Baker Street Irregulars. And aside from missing, I think, maybe a year after the version that they began publishing was too expensive, they stopped, and then they again, reinvigorated it under a more sensible kind of cover and publisher. And the Baker Street Journal has been in print 4 times a year, plus a Christmas annual, ever since.
And so you also, fast forward to 2018, you have a big event coming up, right? The BSI weekend. Just give us a short sketch of what that's all about and where it takes place.
Well, the Baker Street weekend, you know, as Scott said, the origin of all this is back in Christopher Morley's day in the 1930s. This started, as Scott said, with just a group of friends gathering together for conversation because they all had common interests. It's now expanded into quite a formal event. The Baker Street Irregulars is an invitation-only society, but it also has this public face in the Baker Street Journal, which anyone can subscribe to, which is a quarterly publication that also produces a Christmas annual. The society is, it's really today expanded to a global literary society. And there are affiliated groups, hundreds, if not thousands of them around the world, in Japan, in Italy, in Africa, all over the world, people who have a common interest in Sherlock Holmes. So there are affiliated groups that meet locally. But once a year, the main group, the Baker Street Irregulars, meets for a dinner on the Friday closest to Sherlock Holmes' birthday, which Morley had suggested for a variety of reasons, was January 6, 1854. And the organization meets in New York City for a gala dinner that usually brings together some 200 or more people. But there are also other events throughout the weekend. And in fact, Scott has a magnificent website up, which I think is called BSIWeekend2018.com. Is BSI, that the URL?
No, it's just BSIWeekend.com.
Yeah, BSIWeekend.com, where you can go and look at all of the events that are open to everyone and things for a lot of people to participate in beyond the formal dinner that the society has.
Well, it sounds like a lot of fun. One of the things I'd like to kind of maybe switch gears and talk to you about is this show revolves a lot around science and nature. And one of the things that's always intrigued me about Sherlock Holmes is that reading and rereading these stories is a wonderful exercise in neuroplasticity and in having your mind go back in time to that era and seeing the way that he solves problems, or sometimes, you know, how those problems can't be solved. It's that wonderful problem solving that appeals to my intellect.
Well, and I don't think you're too far off, Dave. I think a lot of people appreciate that, you know, remember these stories came out in late Victorian, early Edwardian England. And it was a time when science was really coming into its own, and certainly post-industrial revolution when machinery and hard facts and again, science were taking hold and trying to dispel any uncertainty, any fears that people might have, and to put more, just more confidence into them. And even if it was an escape, you know, we know that even today, you know, removed over 100 years from when these stories were first published, even though we have no firsthand knowledge of that time of our history, there's a certain contentment that allows us to travel back in our minds to this simpler time when right from wrong was easily discerned, when fact from fiction was very clear, you know. And again, I turned back to that very first editor's gas lamp that Edgar Smith wrote in the Baker Street Journal when he asked, "What is it that we love in Sherlock Holmes?" You know, he said it was the half-remembered, half-forgotten times of snug Victorian illusion, of gaslit comfort and contentment, of perfect dignity and grace. And you know, he goes on and lists a number of things there, but the fact that we've got, you know, this combination of Galahad and Socrates bringing high adventure to our dull existence and judicial logic to our biased minds, he is the success of all of our failures, the bold escape from our imprisonment. I think that captures it perfectly.
Yeah. I think so too. I would just add that, your focus on science and neuroplasticity is, I think, exactly right from a couple of standpoints. One is that the inspiration for Sherlock Holmes, Arthur Conan Doyle was a medical student. And when he was studying at the University of Edinburgh, had a professor named Joseph
Bell.
Bell. Right. And Bell preached the science of observation and thinking to his students and would frequently demonstrate by bringing in patients what could be deduced from observing people's physical characteristics, their calluses, the way they dressed, other aspects of their appearance. And bear in mind, too, this is a time when if you were a tradesman, if you were a cobbler, if you were a painter, if you were a seaman, the marks of your profession would probably be more visible. In terms of the deformities or the unique aspects of how your body would adjust to what you were doing. And Bell was able to capture these things at a glance, sometimes with surprising results, and that became a great characteristic of Sherlock Holmes. But second, the thing that's really appealing about Holmes to lots of people is the idea that, gee, if I just did that, if I paid more attention, if I knew how many steps were at the front of my house, if I'd counted them and could remember that number, if I looked about me, if I studied people a bit more closely, this interior world, this secret world about what they do, what their issues are, what their challenges are, what they're thinking, that could be revealed to me. And that, the last thing I would say is that's just carried through the years because the fascination of in Sherlock Holmes has been mirrored by American presidents. Franklin Delano Roosevelt was a secret member of the Baker Street Irregulars. It wasn't publicized in his time, but he had correspondence with Edgar Smith. But also lately, among our number are people like Maria Konnikova, who is a psychology PhD from Columbia, but also a prominent author who has looked at the whole history of psychology through the lens of Sherlock Holmes and written books like How to Think Like Sherlock Holmes. And there are other people who have gone through the canon and compiled books about the science of Sherlock Holmes. So the science, observation, the detail is really fundamental to this interest. And it's not something you would see in other similar or related literary societies.
You made me think of something, the wonderful book that's by Walter Isaacson, that's the biography of Leonardo da Vinci. And one of the central tenets of his genius was the sheer power of his observation skills, that he was an observer of everything and deeply. And that you made me think of that when you talked about Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah, and that's interesting because it's been a characteristic not only of scientists but artists. And Da Vinci's a wonderful example. I was just reading something about Rodin, the sculptor, the other day, who apparently would simply spent a lot of time observing his models. And when he caught his models in a particular pose, just in the course of their everyday activities, he would have them freeze. And then he would jot it down and make a note, make a sketch, and save it. And he was later asked, or criticized actually, by someone in his own studio who said, "Well, this isn't really art if all you're going to do is jot down interesting poses and sort of transform them into works." And he said, "Well, I am highlighting them and emphasizing them so that they can communicate what I want to express." And I either thought that was very insightful or very facile, I don't know which, but it's interesting how much observation has been a part of science and art.
And forensics, it's the key thing, the gathering evidence. And you think about so many television shows that are popular, CSI and CIS, Elementary, they all revolve around observing and then making, inferences and deductions based on what you see and find.
And like X-ray vision or super hearing, that is one of Sherlock Holmes' superpowers. It's doing things that the normal human can't do, but like Batman, who, again, is just a normal human being, one can train themselves to be so if they are so inclined.
A couple of brief answers for the next couple of questions, if you can. Give me your elevator speech. Describe for us what the I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere podcast is for somebody who's never heard it before.
Well, the easiest thing for certainly your listeners to help them understand it, is we are like fresh air for Sherlock Holmes.
That is definitely great. That's a great elevator speech. What about trifles?
Well, that I'll leave to Bert.
Oh, trifles. Trifles is 15 minutes of weekly fun. It's diving down the rabbit hole of this great collection of exciting, interesting detective stories and focusing on details and asking questions and even better, coming up with answers. It's an intellectual activity. It's amusing. It's informative. We never know where it leads. And it's short. So if you only have a couple of minutes to spare, it's a great way to dive in.
One of the things I love about listening to you two together is how spontaneous it is. You know, one of you will pose a point or a question, and then the other will respond. And it's just got this wonderful sense of discovery about your conversations that I find amazing.
Well, I think that's because we try to recreate. I mean, I'm in Michigan. Bert is in New Jersey. So we record this over the internet, but we try to recreate what it would be like if we were seated next to each other across the table, or standing at a bar together and just having a conversation. And I think those are some of the most interesting opportunities for people to get to know us a little bit, because that's part of it. You have to have a little bit of personality when you put these shows together, but also to bring them into this conversation with us, to make them feel like they're part of this circle that's standing around and having the conversation and listening as well.
I'm sorry, I just wanted to say, and it's not overly prepared. You know, we have topics for trifles. And so we know generally what we're going to talk about. But the discovery, you know, the conversation, have you ever thought of this? Have you ever thought of that? You know, just sort of happens naturally. And it's the nice part is that when you know this collection of stories and these events in some detail, you can put a lot of different things together. And that's just part of the joy of it. You know, just talking about something like technology and Sherlock Holmes, or science and Sherlock Holmes, you know, you never know quite where that can lead.
And that's the thing I enjoy about it, is that sense of, oh, I never quite looked at it that way, that you two bounce off each other. And that's what makes it, like you said, very natural. It's a wonderful podcast. I look forward to it every week. Let's talk about young people. One of your recent episodes of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, you discussed, I'm trying to remember the woman's name. She's an educator. Shannon Carlyle and the Junior Sherlockian Society. What's the best gateway, entryway to bring a young person into the world of Sherlock Holmes?
You know, I think like anyone, there's a variety of ways. You know, we know people that first got into Sherlock Holmes, as we did, from reading the stories. We know other people that saw the Basil Rathbone Nigel Bruce movies as their first exposure, or that watched Jeremy Brett or Benedict Cumberbatch. And now, of course, we have video games, we have comic books, we have all sorts of ways for kids to discover Sherlock Holmes. So ultimately, it's whatever interests them is the best way in. The 60 stories will always be there at the center. But having an interested and interesting educator or some kind of authority figure to them whom they trust and whom they listen to, introduce them in somewhat more of a gentle way, could be one way to help them get interested. For example, Shannon said that she started out with the Blue Carbuncle and the Red-Headed League as two of the stories that she introduces the kids to. And she uses abridged children's versions to help them get more in touch with it, because she teaches at the fourth grade level. So I think having someone there as a mediator, as a facilitator, to really help them get more out of it, will put them on the right path.
Yeah, I very much agree. I think in general, the best way to get a young person involved in this is to give them something to read. For a very young child, Basil of Baker Street or the Disney Great Mouse Detective movie is a nice introduction. I think, though, to the point Scott just made, I would suggest that the adults engaged exercise some caution. Based on my own experience of introducing my eldest daughter to Sherlock Holmes, which was quite successful because she's still a Sherlock Holmes enthusiast, I gave her a story that it never occurred to me because I was an adult that she would find as a young person very disturbing because of the crime and the way the murder was committed and so on. And so you do, Shannon Carlyle is to be saluted for these abridged child-friendly versions of the stories that she's using.
Let's take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Sherlock Holmes experts Scott Monty and Bert Wolder. I'm Dave Schlom, and you're listening to Blue Dot. Stay with us.
Sherlock Holmes famously said, "You see, but do not observe," and science is all about observation. From the first time I read a story where Holmes correctly identified the occupation and circumstances of a person he'd only met for a few moments, I was hooked. That level of detailed consideration is precisely what's required in historical archaeology. We must rely on all five of your senses when you're in the field excavating, and then determine how what you saw and found fits into an historical and cultural framework. All archaeologists are detectives because we attempt to reconstruct past events from material clues. But historical archaeologists, like me, who study written texts and addition artifacts, are also charged with thinking about human motive. We tend to be fanatics about mystery fiction, and Sherlock Holmes in particular, so he might well be the fictional patron saint of our field.
Thanks to archaeologist and author Dana Cameron for that. And now let's get back to our interview with Scott Monty and Bert Wolder.
Okay, I'm going to put you on the proverbial psychologist's couch now, so imagine yourself laying back. And I want you to come up with just briefly, whatever comes to your mind, I'm going to hit you with, six characters from Sherlock Holmes. And I want you to, whatever words come to mind, to describe them as briefly as you can. Let's start with Inspector Lestrade.
A sallow, rat-faced fellow.
Bert?
Inspector Lestrade, earnest, I think is the best single word I would pick to describe Inspector Lestrade. He is, after all, a Scotland Yard inspector, and he is not the brightest of the Yard's force.
But he's the pick of a bad lot, right?
Yes, the pick of a bad lot, yes.
Mycroft Holmes.
Single words about Mycroft. Well, the thing that always sticks to me about Mycroft is his size. You know, he is immense, but Mycroft is more aptly known as the British government. Mycroft has intellectual powers and abilities greater than Holmes, and does mysterious things for the British government, and seems to be a person of great power and influence.
Yeah, I would say corpulent, smarter, armchair detective.
Oh, very good, yeah.
Isn't it Mycroft that renders those words I hear of Sherlock everywhere?
He is indeed, in the Greek interpreter. He first meets Dr. Watson and says, "I hear of Sherlock everywhere since you became his chronicler."
How about Mrs. Hudson?
Oh, dear.
Oh, dear. She's the beloved housekeeper and landlady of Sherlock Holmes. So I would say... kindly, beloved, maternal are the words that come to mind when I think of Mrs. Hudson. Hmm.
And I would say ever-present and reliable.
Well, not so kindly. How about Moriarty?
Evil
a spider
genius.
Sitting at the center of a great web.
Yes. Evil genius, arch nemesis. I mean, he is the classic villain, the classic anti-hero.
John H. Watson, M.D.
Stalwart.
Every man, the reader. Actually, yes. The lovely thing about Watson, and of course the whole Holmes story, is that these are tales, most of them, presented to us by Watson, who's participating in these events. So he's a great stand-in for all of us.
Mm. And I think every man is great. I would also say stalwart and loyal.
And Sherlock Holmes.
The best and wisest man we have ever known.
There you go. Can't improve upon that.
No. And just to round it out, how about Irene Adler?
The woman.
Smarter, yeah.
And not corpulent.
If you could have someone on your show that's impossible, that being Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, what would you like to ask him? He was a spiritualist. Maybe you can contact him. I don't know.
I would ask him. I mean, we knew when he was alive, he obviously wanted to focus more on the work that he thought was more important, his historical fiction, his spiritualism. And he begrudgingly admitted that Sherlock Holmes was part of this long train that he hauled behind him. And I think he actually sketched it out at one point. You know, of all of the things that he accomplished in his life, Sherlock Holmes was certainly a part of that. But I would want to know if he were surprised at the keen interest that there still is in Sherlock Holmes 130 years after he first introduced him.
Yes, I find it difficult to imagine that he would have foreseen how huge a franchise it would become.
Oh, yeah, I think so. I think he would have been surprised. There have been so many biographies about Conan Doyle that we at this point really know a tremendous amount of his life and his experience. I suppose if he were here, I like Scott, I would be interested in, you know, what he thought of the continued interest. But I would also like to ask him, you know, what we could do to create more Conan Doyles. You know, today, you know, we live in a society that somehow feels afflicted by amnesia. Conan Doyle honored the past. He was deeply influenced by his mother. He loved tales of the Round Table and of knightly behavior. You know, we have a general feeling in society today, sometimes I think, that in general we're becoming more ignorant as a people, despite the vast amount of information that's available. Conan Doyle was well-read and informed on any number of topics. I would like to know from him what he thinks we could do to create new generations of people like him.
Well, on that note, we're about out of time, and I wanted to let you know I appreciate you so much for coming on the show.
We're glad to do it.
Well, thank you. Thank you for patiently listening to our babbling.
Oh, it's very fun to listen to your babbling. And I'd also just like to add that when I look at, when I listen to the podcasts, especially Trifles every week, and you're going into your second year, so congratulations on that. And look at your website and everything, it's and the social media. It strikes me that you put a tremendous amount of time into this enterprise. And that just, to me, says passion for something.
Well, I think you're right. You know, we tallied it up in our final episode of 2017. Between Trifles and I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, we produced 76 episodes over the course of the year. And Trifles are about 15 minutes long each. There were 52 of those, and there were 26 episodes of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, which is an hour long. So that's a lot of hours of finished shows, and you can only imagine what actually goes into behind the scenes in actually producing them. So mm-hmm. if we didn't have passion, you know, we're getting enough money in from our faithful listeners to cover the costs of production and distribution, and that's it. There's no slush fund. There's no trips to London for us anytime soon, unfortunately.
No. So those are my worst fears confirmed. No Christmas bonus.
No.
Oh. Well.
The bonus is more episodes.
That's our new campaign. Send Scott and Bert to London.
Here, here.
But we may not have enough money to bring you back.
That's okay.
That's what. Got to make a start.
That's preferred.
Start is fun.
What do your friends and family think of all this? You know, do they? Oh, there they go again with their Sherlock Holmes.
That's a kind way of putting it. Yeah, there's a touch of the insanity I think that we have. That they think we have. But you know, it's either this or being out drinking every night, and I think they prefer us to do this.
Oh, wait a minute. I didn't realize there was a trade-off.
I was going to say, are they mutually exclusive?
Do both? Uh-oh. Yeah. I'll drink to that.
A glass of scotch and go edit your podcast.
No. Well, thank you, sirs.
Dave, we record drunk. We edit sober.
There you go. That's definitely the ticket. Well, both of you, best of luck with the podcasts in this coming year. And I hope next year Trifles wins that Best Podcast Award.
Well, thank you.
I think it's just outstanding. It's helped deepen my love for Sherlock Holmes and his world.
Wow. It's really gratifying to hear.
Thanks to our guests, Scott Monty and Bert Wolder. You can check out their podcasts, I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, and Trifles at ihose.com. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio. Check out this and past episodes at mynspr.org, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is produced and engineered by the man on the board, Nolan Ford. Thanks for listening. Join us again next week for all of us here. I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.